You are unmuted.
Good evening, everybody. This is Rick Reynolds, and I'm here with my illustrious bride, Stephanie. She's been my bride of 31 years, and she's going to help with the call tonight. I had not anticipated how difficult it was going to be to round all of our staff up with everybody traveling. So at least the most important part of my staff is here, my sweet wife. We've got a chat feature here. For those of you who are logged in via TalkShoe, you certainly can also post questions by chat, and we'd love to have any sort of comments that you would have. So I'm just going to begin by talking by what I've observed in the office over the last few days. I guess since the whole Tiger Woods affair started and this thing began to come out, what all of us at the Affair Recovery Center began to notice is many of our couples began to really spin out. I mean, I had couples coming in that had been doing well for as long as 3 years, and suddenly they were just kind of back into the fear mode, back into the questioning mode. And we began to notice that there is what we have now coined the Tiger Woods effect, where if couples who are down the road and doing well, just the fact that there's a large exposure to something like this begins to raise doubts, it begins to raise fears. And sometimes some of the old coping behaviors that couples had used during the recovery process begin to come back. I mean, they were again looking for reassurance. Some people, I think because of a trauma wound, actually began to re-experience a lot of the pain. And it was like their, their trauma wound was being activated. And frequently when someone has PTSD, as post-traumatic stress disorder, that PTSD can be reactivated. And as long as there's nothing triggering the PTSD, that person will do okay. However, if there are multiple reminders, at times that trauma can be reactivated. And at that point, they began to experience a lot of the same anxiety, the same fear, the same anger that they actually were experiencing at the point of disclosure long ago. So we want to talk a little bit tonight about, and we just want to get people, first off, to answer their questions about all of this and a little bit about PTSD. We'll talk some about how to deactivate trauma wounds, how to deal with the whole Tiger Woods effect. And again, for those of you who are live on the call tonight, you certainly can type in questions. It looks like we've got quite a number of people online, and we'd love to try to get to everybody. I don't know that we actually can, because there's going to be more people than we have time, I can tell, but we can certainly start with the questions that have been posted. So can you say hi to everyone, Stephanie?
Hello, everyone.
Yeah, that's the good bride here. PTSD. Our first question tonight, I want to know how after 3 years of an affair that my husband had, and he was jailed for 3 days for home violence, how he can heal. I think he's suffering from PTSD. Whenever an example of Tiger occurs in the newspaper or even a movie scene, is there hope? I love him and want him to have help. And that's an interesting question, simply because not all the people being affected are the people who have been hurt. Oftentimes, the Tiger would, this type of news item can actually create a problem for the person who is unfaithful and trigger a lot of their fear, and cause them to go more into an old coping way of shutting down. If someone, Stephanie's nodding at me to quit stuttering, if someone, I think, has post-traumatic stress disorder where they're still experiencing a significant amount of pain and hurt when something's brought up, and it's a number of years or a number of months afterwards, and they're still kind of getting the same response, they really need to begin to address the issue of the post-traumatic stress disorder. Post-traumatic stress disorder is a trauma wound that really, in many ways, kind of hardwires the limbic system. And what it causes, it's more of a physiological reaction, but it causes that person, whenever that trauma is activated, to go into a fight or flight sort of state, and they move more into the amygdala. And because the emotions are so intense as a result of the trauma wound, they go to a place where it's just need or feed, and they don't have the ability to be rational anymore. And until they're able to calm down, it's difficult for them to discuss and to deal with the entire situation. Research has shown that once your pulse rate pops 100, let's say that you're sitting there talking to your mate, something comes on about Tiger, you get activated and the sympathetic nervous system and your pulse rate jumps over 100, research shows that you really have no way of actually being rational. And so that's a problem. And one way you can actually check this out, we actually at the ARC will have people wear pulse watches when they're home. And if they're being activated, that sympathetic nervous system, their pulse rate will frequently spike to like 115 or 120 from a resting heart rate in just kind of one sentence. And that's at that point, they've got to be able to calm down before they can deal with anything. So someone with PTSD probably needs to see a therapist who specializes in PTSD. One of the primary techniques that's used with PTSD is called EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And there are specific techniques that can be used to help them manage, it's called emotional regulation, help them manage those emotions as they begin to flood. So I would suggest for your husband, if he's still struggling after 3 years and getting triggered and still getting either anxious or whatever and goes kind of out of control with those emotions, that they do go in, and he does go in and get help with someone or from someone. Okay.
You want to do this one? Why don't I read it?
You can read it.
That would just give them a little break. This person says, I guess my only comment would be how to respond to those who, now that it seems Elon is leaving him, can't help but wonder aloud how you could still be staying with your betrayer. I know you can't live your life overly concerned about what others think of you, but it's yet another deep pain to my fragile ego and self-esteem, knowing others think Elon the strong one for leaving and you the weak, afraid one for staying. In reality, I think it's the opposite. How, besides distancing yourself from these toxic people, can you respond or stop your mind from swaying into that realm of thinking that tells you, quote, maybe you are stupid for staying with him?
So how would you answer that, Steph?
Well, you know, we really don't know much about this couple. To believe what the media says is dangerous, or to believe everything that the media says is dangerous, we have no idea what his attitude, what his heart is like, nothing at all. So to judge her as being strong because she's leaving, I just don't think that there's enough information for us to make a judgment on whether or not she's strong or weak or whatever. You know, and I understand this person is just, she says, my fragile ego and self-esteem, worrying now that people will think that she is perhaps the weak one because she stayed. That's a tough place to be, because I guess part of me wants to say, well, I think about myself. I, you know, when Rick was unfaithful, the hardest thing to do was to stay and work through it. It would have been much easier to have left and just not had to deal with it. So I felt like leaving would have sort of been the, you know, taking the, I hate to say the chicken way out, but, you know, in our particular situation, for me, it seemed like the more courageous decision was to stay and work on the relationship. Every situation of infidelity is different. I don't think there's any way at all to use a cookie cutter plan in dealing with, you know, whether or not the betrayed is being strong by leaving or being strong by staying. I think that distancing, like she says, how besides distancing yourself from these toxic people can you respond? Well, that's the best thing to do, is to distance yourself from those toxic people. Those are not the kind of people that you want to spend time with in the first place, because they're probably not going to be supportive of your marriage. And I don't know about this lady, but or this gentleman, but I want to be around people who are going to be supportive of my marriage. But as far as stopping her mind from swaying into that realm of thinking, that tells you maybe you are stupid for staying with him? Well, I would have to say I would spend some time in the scriptures, finding scriptures that really speak to being, you know, obedient to the Lord and what He has said to you. And I would memorize scripture. I would take control of my thoughts and turn them over to Jesus.
You know, the other thing, I think just because she says that she's leaving this week doesn't mean that she'll be leaving next week. I find many couples, someone makes a decision in week three or week four that they're going to do this or do that. By a year, all of that has changed. Probably the biggest factor that will determine whether or not she leaves or stays will have a lot to do with his heart attitude.
Yeah.
And I have no idea, again, where he's at and how he's responding to her. But at another level, that may bring us to kind of that next question down here. But if he changes, there still may be a possibility that she would consider even being with him. But there would have to be a pretty significant turnaround. And the other thing, everybody thinks they know how they would respond in this situation. Bottom line is, until you're there, nobody knows really how they're going to respond. I have your friends that judge you. I have people all the time that tell me how they gave a hard time to somebody because they ended up staying with their mate, saying that, you know, they would never do that sort of thing, and then turn right back around after their mate ends up cheating on them, and they end up staying, and they surprise themselves.
And I remember saying that when I thought about the possibility of you ever being unfaithful, I thought I would just be out of there. You know, I wouldn't be insulted and submit myself to that kind of behavior, but I didn't.
So in many ways, when you're talking to people, I think it's important to find people to talk to who at least have been through this type of situation. To talk to people who have never experienced it, they're never going to be able to really give you an honest opinion just because they don't know what they would do given that same situation. I was thinking this one here.
Where it says, do you think there's any hope of him changing without a complete turnaround of his life, i.e. turning to God?
And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, after at least reading, I was writing something last night and it just hit me, you know, that I am Tiger Woods, maybe a recovering Tiger Woods, but I think I know a little bit of the place he comes from an addictive standpoint, and I don't know the soul who's able to overcome this in their own willpower. I don't think this is something you say, I'm just going to kind of get over it, not at the magnitude that Tiger was doing this. I mean, it's kind of frightening simply because when you're in that addiction, there's so little regard ultimately for caring for people. And part of this is about being able to develop empathy, being able to get over yourself and recognize that no matter how much money you have, you're really not that important, that life isn't about you, that you're really supposed to be about life, that you're not really in control, and, you know, that life is hard. And there are things far more important than your own selfish gratification at the expense of other people. And I just think you've got to be with other people in recovery to help recalibrate your heart, to help recalibrate how you think. There needs to be almost an acceptance that, you know, apart from somebody bigger than me, I can't do this. Thomas Keating says that all of us have to go through a very necessary path of humiliations before we finally let go of our egocentric selves. And I suspect for someone like Tiger, until that his ego, his own pride is destabilized and he's willing to accept that, you know, maybe his best efforts keep coming to this place, that he probably won't let go. And that's why I think they do have to have some sort of almost surrender or conversion experience and ability to accept who you are. And I think that happens primarily through that whole God experience. So, do you have another question there?
Well, gee, I was trying to categorize them just a little bit. This particular person says, many wives feel triggered to interrogate their husband relentlessly, a occasionally or not at all. And in parentheses, it says stuff it. What should be the non-defensive response of a sober slash recovering husband who is doing the best he can? Should the husband encourage the wife to, quote, ask anything, or does he have the right to demand the wife forgive and forget?
Certainly, I would say he does not have a right to demand that she forgive and forget. I hope that the unfaithful spouse is willing to do whatever is necessary to help their mate heal from a wound that he or she created as a result of their carelessness or their addiction or whatever was going on with them. But certainly not to forgive, just say, man, you've got to forgive and forget. That, to me, almost puts the hurt spouse in a position where they have to potentially stuff their own feelings. And going forward, I think pain that ultimately isn't transformed is going to be transmitted. And if they don't deal with that pain, it's going to start coming out in some very, very destructive ways farther down the line. So I think the unfaithful spouse, as their mate is beginning to ask questions, needs to try to answer the questions, give them the information. One of the things that you'll read in The Shocking Truth About Trust is it's really difficult to get someone to trust you if you don't first begin to trust them with the necessary information. There is, however, a place in recovery, I believe, that for the hurt spouse, that once you really have asked the questions and you've gotten your mind around it, and this is months down the road and it's different for every person, but there comes a place where asking the questions can almost be addictive in itself. It's almost like you don't know how to move beyond the question-asking stage. That does not happen in all cases. And like I said, you may be talking 12 months before that's a problem. And at that point, the person asking the question needs to begin to say, okay, what benefit is there in asking this? And what I mean by that is if you're looking to the unfaithful spouse to answer questions as a way of feeling secure, if that's the only way you can find security and reconnection is through the questions, then what will happen is you're going to have to continue digging and stripping away for more and more detail just to be thinking of questions to ask so that they can once again prove their love to you by asking or answering those very difficult questions. That's where it begins to be a very destructive pattern. But that's much farther into the relationship.
Well, just an addition to that, Rick, I remember you telling me when there were questions that I asked that you maybe felt like they were going to be really difficult for me to hear the truth in, you would ask me to wait 24 hours and see if I still wanted to ask that question. And sometimes there were questions with a lot of details in them. And that was helpful. We talked about that at the time, and that was the agreement that we had. So you did tell me I could ask you anything, but you did, you know, we did talk about some of those things waiting 24 hours.
And the other thing on questions that I think is important, the main purpose of questions is to be able to get the picture of ultimately what mm-hmm. happened and get your head around it and to be able to see the whole situation. The types of questions, I think, that become very destructive are what I call comparison questions. So when you begin to ask questions where you're comparing yourself against an affair partner or pornography or whatever, at that point, I don't know that there's a lot of benefit in the comparison questions because they don't have anything to do with the detail of the what, where, when, how, why. Those questions probably are very helpful in terms of understanding. The comparison questions, I think, really bring up a lot of very negative intrusive thoughts farther down the line, and the intrusive thoughts will go away, but remember the purpose of the questions, and the purpose of those questions ultimately is to be able to understand what was there, and once you think you've got it, you really do want to try to make a concerted effort to move beyond the question-asking stage. If someone is stuck continually having to check, that to me may be an indication of post-traumatic stress disorder. and they're just using the questions as a way of modulating kind of ongoing anxiety, and for whatever reason, the magnitude of the pain isn't subsiding, and so you may need to do some additional work to help regulate that. And some of you may be going, well, that's not fair, because if you're the hurt spouse, I mean, why in the world should I have to go do work for something that my mate did? But, you know, let's face it, if you were in a car and somebody else was driving the car and they had a wreck and you broke your leg and you had to go to physical therapy, it might not be fair that you had to do the physical therapy, but if you ever want to walk again normally, you really are going to have to do the work necessary to deal with that trauma wound. Again, back to Tiger, this sort of thing stirs up those wounds, and for some of you is probably revealing kind of a place in the wound that maybe never totally healed. And so hopefully, you know, we can give you some ideas of how to deal with that.
Here's two that are similar, so I'm going to read both of them, and I think you can address them together. This one says, there are many phases and degrees of self-worthlessness that are associated with affairs and marriages. My biggest hurdle is trying to get over feeling stupid for staying. My husband cheated on me twice, and I can't help feeling like my heart has been stomped on, and I am signing up for it again. I often feel like a doormat. How do I get over these feelings and try to do my part in healing this marriage? And the next person is a little longer. Says, when you're married to someone who has a repeat problem, much like Tiger seems to have, there is never a guarantee this will not happen again. Your spouse may be as nice as can be and make all the right moves for the public eye, again, much like Tiger. But in private, that facade can crack and more of the real person comes out. When you've been hurt repeatedly and over a course of years, just like Tiger's wife, what type of safety net does the hurt spouse have to try and prevent this from happening and having their heart crushed again? All of the promises to never do this again may very much be meant by the offending spouse, but if you've heard it all for the 100th time, how is the hurt spouse supposed to put any type of boundaries in place so that the offending spouse doesn't just walk all over them again? It's almost as if the perception is that if the offending spouse is a nice guy, much like Tiger, the hurt spouse should overlook the affairs due to the fact the offender is nice. If Tiger had been abusing his spouse or children, or not the all-around likable person he had portrayed to the public, it doesn't seem the public would be as accepting of his behavior as they have been. Personally, I don't think they've been accepting of his behavior, but that's why is it that if the offending spouse is nice, we are expected to overlook persistent problems? When is it safe to stay or better to go with a spouse that reflects that nice guy image when you are never really sure of what is going on due to past behavior?
Okay, you asked about 17 questions there.
I didn't. Somebody wrote these questions.
Okay.
I just read the two of them together because I seem to be very similar. Just trying to, you know, how do I keep from getting my heart stomped on, and how do I know, I mean, when I've heard it 100 times that it's never going to happen again, and they continue to be repeat offenders, you know, and they seem to indicate that the public is thinking, well, he's a nice guy, so it's not so bad. I haven't gotten that impression, but.
Well, first off, I don't think that if a mate tells their husband or their wife that they'll never do it again, as far as I'm concerned, that person is absolutely not safe. That's the first sign. The people I know who are really safe in recovery are the ones who accept the fact that because they've done it once, they know full well that they can do it again, and it's only by the grace of God if that doesn't happen. And so I've never had anybody relapse because they're weak. I only have people relapse because they're strong and they think they can handle it and they think they won't do it again. And because they think they won't do it again, they put themselves in really high-risk situations and put their family at risk. But if they can accept the fact that, you know, it's a real possibility for them, they've done it once, they can do it again, that person, believe it or not, is far safer than the other one.
Sounds like it's kind of a pride issue.
Oh, yeah. I mean, people fall over pride. I mean, they just think, I would never do it twice. I mean, that's why a person in recovery, you know, they say, you know, I had this problem. I mean, I know I'm an alcoholic. I know I'm a sex addict. I accept what I am. But until the person is able to accept what they are, they never live in the solution. They're always trying to prove they don't have the problem. And let's face it, if you've got somebody who's a sex addict trying to prove that they don't have a problem, the only way they're going to be able to prove they don't have a problem is putting themselves in the situations ultimately where the problem occurs. Second, just because someone is nice and is convincing certainly isn't a good reason, again, I think, to stay with them. And I don't know, let me look at some of that question a little bit. I want to make sure I'm catching everything that person is asking. Which one is it here?
This is not my question.
You're right. In terms of when you're married to someone that has a problem, a repeat problem, much like Tiger seems, there's never a guarantee that won't happen again. And even if they make the right move in the public eye, but in private, that facade can crack. And right. The other thing is, somebody in recovery, the one thing you're going to notice is they are not into image management. They're the ones that if someone says, you're a dog, they go, well, actually, it's probably a lot worse than that. I mean, I'm just trying to get my mind around how bad I really am. Because in recovery, what that person is focused on is rigorous honesty and authenticity. Learning to be real and not playing the game of pretending to be something they're not. Anytime you've got a mate who's in pretend normal, I believe that they're going to be at risk of acting out again. When you've got somebody who's able to accept what their issue is and they take responsibility for it and they're trying to be authentic about it and they're not doing image management, again, that person is the safe person. So I get very leery of people who look really good on the outside because I always say the best of the flesh is the worst of the flesh, and it's still my flesh. I used to have two horses, App and Bella, and Bella was a little bit of a she-devil, but App was really good, you know, at unlocking gates. And, you know, if App unlocked one of the gates and the good horse got out, it was really interesting because the bad horse was always, you know, close behind. And I think it's that way with us. If we're trying to be really, really good, ultimately the other side of us isn't that far off. But when we're trying to live in acceptance, that's not about trying to be good. That's just about trying to be authentic and about doing what's necessary to keep the people I love safe.
Here's one. There's several questions in here, and I was trying to kind of make it more concise, but I'll read the whole thing. I keep hearing that he had a reputation for womanizing before he got married, so why would he decide to marry and say he was happy being a family man when he continued to cheat on his wife?
Hold that for a second.
Okay,
so I think a lot of times people believe, sex addicts falsely believe, that when they get married and when they stand at the altar and say, I promise to love and cherish and be faithful and all those things, they're serious as a heart attack. And they believe that they'll be able to substitute maybe their kind of whatever that behavior was prior to marriage, that somehow the marriage will satisfy that. I think with most sex addicts in particular, since I think we're dealing with more of a sexual addiction with Tiger, and I think probably many of these questions relate to sexual addiction, because understand there are six different types of affairs, and we're just talking kind of about what we call a Category 3 right here. But when they get married, they find out that the marriage scratches a very different itch. I mean, I always say when I grew up, I learned that bad sex was really, really good. When I got married, I thought that marital sex would be a lot like bad, like whatever I was experiencing outside of marriage. But I found out that marital sex was very different, and it didn't do the same thing. And so ultimately all that happened was I ended up adding to my sexual repertoire. Now I had bad sex and good sex. I don't know if that's what happened to Tiger, and if Tiger was serious about really trying to maybe quit all this stuff. I mean, don't know the man, don't know his heart. But I do know that oftentimes people get into marriage, find out that the urge for the other behaviors don't go away, and it's not long until they're back into old behaviors again.
They go on to say one of the things, I wonder what happened to him that he feels it's okay to cheat on his wife and act like it's no big deal until he gets caught.
And I think that in our culture, and this is really frightening, but it's kind of like, you know, no blood, no foul. In other words, if you're not caught, if as long as nobody's being hurt, somehow it's not wrong. And that's almost a barbaric way of thinking. And this is not a behavior you can do and not have it hurt other people. And there's got to be a certain level of just almost, I mean, not almost, of just an incredible self-centeredness and a lack of empathy, a lack of considering what the impact will be. And I find that it's really difficult oftentimes for people who aren't addicts to kind of understand the magnitude of the compartmentalization. But probably if Tiger's like many of the other people I've treated, he wasn't even thinking about his wife. And that's kind of hard to believe because most of us, or maybe many of you, I was able to compartmentalize being an addict, you know, can't imagine doing that without thinking about your home life and your family and your kids all the time. But part of the disease that I think is sexual addiction is you're trying to fill an incredible void on the inside, and you're just using people. I mean, you don't, at that moment, you don't care about people. You're using them more or less just as objects. So, let's see, next part of the question here, madam.
Well, the next part's interesting. It says, I have read that his dad cheated on his mom. Do you think that has had an effect on him?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And I think a lot of times there's a father wound. Remember what I said, the pain that is not transformed will be transmitted. And I can't tell you how many times I've worked with people who have been really wounded because their mom or their dad cheated in the marriage. It's the last thing in the world they want. They determine they're not going to do it, and it's the very thing they end up doing. Same thing with suicide. I mean, one of the things that's really bad about someone committing suicide is there's a strong probability that someone in the next generation, in the next two generations, will also commit suicide. It's almost like there's a strange form of permission. And even that vow not to do something, there's a term called psychological reactivity that we as human beings, when we decide we don't really want to do something, it actually increases the probabilities of us doing it. So, and I'll always use the example of, for all of you online tonight, if I said, okay, picture a pink elephant in your mind, now that you've got the pink elephant in your mind, tell me when you quit thinking about it. And the fact is, the harder we try not to think about something, the more we ultimately think about it, which is as we try to attack the problem and try to control the problem, ultimately that's what causes us to lose control. I can keep going.
Another question. What can you say to the men out there who idolize Tiger? My husband thinks he's the greatest golfer ever, and so do I. But this has been such a big disappointment for both of us. It brings up many reminders for my husband concerning the affair he had. So do you have anything encouraging for us to say from all of this?
Well, obviously, what makes a great man isn't his ability ultimately to hit a golf ball. I think that a man is defined far more by his refusals than by his accomplishments. I've known a lot of very, very successful men who have absolutely incredible accomplishments, but I don't consider them good quality men. The men I know who refuse to maybe give in to temptation, they may not have accomplished as much in life, who refuse to lie, who refuse to cover up, who refuse to just kind of seek their own selfish gratification. You're going to be able to judge a person far more by their refusals, the quality of who they are. The other thing that I measure people by isn't just the refusals, but their responses. When I see somebody respond with brokenness and where they're not defensive, where they're actually able to have enough ego integrity to take responsibility for their actions, that person, as far as I'm concerned, has far more character than someone who's able to hit a golf ball 350 yards, you know, straight down the fairway. A skill, I mean, Tiger Woods is amazingly skilled, as are some of his mentors, Charles Barkley or Michael Jordan. I mean, amazing athletes, but someone being a good athlete doesn't mean that someone has the ability to really care and to love, doesn't mean they have good integrity. So I would say to all of those men out there who are working hard at loving and working hard at understanding and working hard at being honest and working hard at acceptance and working hard at just giving their life to other people now, that person to me in the long run has far more impact on the world than someone who can shoot a basketball or hit a golf ball.
Here's a question. I'm not sure. She just says, what this person, I don't know if it's male or female, what is healthy detachment? Is that a term that's been thrown around with?
Detachment. I don't know about detachment. I think that's just more of a recovery term. A lot of times, if your own sense of esteem, your own sense of happiness is attached to another person, then we would ultimately say that that's codependent. Ultimately, I want my motivations, my life to be focused far more on me, far more on my own spiritual relationship with God. I want to be acting out of not a tit for tat or a codependent person actually is in a one-way relationship oftentimes. They give in order to get. It's not unconditional, but everything they do is in hopes of getting something back to them. And even if you're really a giving person but you're expecting something back, it still makes you 100% totally self-centered. It's still all about you, even though it appears that you're trying to give to another person. The person who is healthily detached, they don't love with an expectation of something back in return. They're focused on their own 2 feet and standing firm and trying to operate out of a base of maybe the true self, not what I would call the false self. And they're being true to what they feel God's calling them to. How the other person responds at that point really is sort of irrelevant to them. If they do something nice and the other person doesn't respond well, if you're really doing it out of your own sense of self and out of your own kind of relationship with the Lord, it doesn't make any difference how the other person responds because you weren't doing it for them in the first place. And that is what detachment in my mind is largely about. I'm not doing it for another person. The other thing detachment can mean is if you've been in enabling behaviors, let's say that you're what I call up a badge. You've got this amazing fear of being a disappointment. Someone who's detached actually will act in the best interest of another person, even if the words they're speaking, the actions they're taking are painful and difficult for the other person. But if you're for bad, fear of being a disappointment, you'll always compromise yourself. You're not detached. You're still being completely controlled by another person and whether or not they're disappointed. So it's important, I think, to be able to do that sort of detachment.
Okay, here is one. Can that kind of selfishness really be changed? Can someone that wrapped up in the excitement and power that those actions create let go of them? Has someone that selfish ever been able to repair the pain they have caused their entire family? Why do we put so much emphasis on the involved partner? I think the wronged partner has a bigger hell to get through than the involved partner who has been having their needs met, in some cases on a daily, if not weekly, basis. I am so tired of all the attention men get for this childish and hurtful behavior.
So let me answer that from the back to the front. First off, I've always said that the hurt spouse has a far, far more difficult journey than the person who was unfaithful. And why I think the unfaithful spouse gets the attention because it's just more spectacular. And in the news circles, it's really cool to hear about, not cool, but it's, you know, just shocking to hear what someone like Tiger Woods would do. But you're absolutely right. The person who has the more difficult journey is the one who's got to forgive and who's been wounded. One of the things I think I realized a while back is that, in my mind, probably the greatest act of love in the history of mankind was the example of Jesus walking the Via Dolorosa, the way of suffering. And the Gospels taught that he did that so that he could be reconciled with us. He had to bear the pain of our failure in order to be reconciled to us. Well, I feel like the hurt spouse, if there's ever going to be reconciliation in any situation like this, it's always the hurt spouse that has to bear the pain, walk the Via de la Rosa, if there's going to be any type of reconciliation, if the relationship is to be healed. The person who's been unfaithful, he really can't bear the pain. I mean, the person who's wounded, I mean, it is now your mate's pain. And I try to get all the unfaithful spouses out there to understand it's an amazing gift if your mate chooses to stay with you. And certainly, it's not what we deserve. I remember in my own recovery, when I first, the first person I talked to before I told Stephanie, he just said to me, he straight up, I mean,
the pastor friend.
Yeah, he just said, "What's God telling you?" And I said, "It's funny you should ask, but he's telling me I need to tell my wife and tell my best friend what's going on. And that, you know, we're having this affair. But that doesn't make sense to me, because why should I let them know? Why should they be hurt because of what I've done?" And he just said, "Well, if God says it, why does it need to make sense to you?" And I kind of thought, yeah, that's right. Because I needed to get off the throne. But the next thing he said was even more significant. He said, "What's the consequence of sin?" And I said, "Well, you know, the Bible would say that would be death." And he said, "Right. So anything that you get short of death is really mercy. You're getting less than what you really deserve. You know, regardless of what Elon does or what anybody that's been betrayed does, for those of us that have been unfaithful, we're getting an amazing mercy. We're getting far less than we deserve. And if there's reconciliation, we certainly need to recognize that it's the hurt spouse that really is paying the price for what we've done so that a relationship can still exist. And if you're not thankful and grateful for that, there's something really jacked up about you and something really wrong. One other thing, at the end, you talk about, I'm so tired of all the attention men get for this childish and hurtful behavior. I'm tired of all the attention Tiger's getting because it's messing up a lot of my clients. But just for the record, probably 50% of the cases I see now are women. So it's not just men's childish behavior anymore, sad to say. I'm sorry that there are both parties out there that fell in love. One thing, and I meant to say this on detachment, one of the things that at the Affair Recovery Center we really believe is that love will always act in the best interest of another person. It's not interested in trying to please them. It's really trying to think about what's best for them and being really, in a heartfelt way, trying to help them and respond to them in love. That takes far more than not being a disappointment. The one last thing here at the very beginning, can this type of selfishness really be changed? And the answer to that is, absolutely. However, that takes, I think, almost a minor miracle. I'll try to explain this shortly, but we all have, I think we're all born DOA, kind of dead on arrival, cut off from God. In many ways, we're all kind of this little egocentric self. Jung called it the separate self, that it's really not the true self. It's this little kind of calculative self, the egocentric self, the small I. And that part of me is always about me and how people love me, see me, adore me, how they respond to me. And it's like we're always trying to get our needs met or get other people ultimately to meet our needs. Someone like Tiger has been, you know, he's got a huge void on the inside. He must have done everything he did in a single day, just like I must have had. I do have a huge void on the inside of me. And it's an insatiable appetite, and we use people. For someone to shift from that position, however, as Keating would say, we have to go through a path of very necessary humiliations until that small self is basically destabilized, or we have a God encounter where we recognize there's something bigger than us outside of us, which again destabilizes that ego. And, you know, to me, the reason religion is so important is it's the only paradigm that begins to explain how you move from that egocentric self, your own self-centeredness, and let go of that and move into the true self, into the center. I mean, to me, when we're in that egocentric self, like I believe Tiger would be, I don't know, I don't want to judge him, but I can't imagine not. At that point, we're eccentric. I mean, we're off-center. We're not in the middle. We're really nothing. We're dangerous, actually. We're just human wrecking balls. When we can recognize that and that ego is destabilized, and that's what is talked about in 12-step work, we finally accept that we're not in control, we're not that important, that life isn't about us, that we, all of our best efforts have brought us to this place. And it's not until you come to the end of you, I always say, you know, God's physical address is at the end of your rope. It's not until we come to that place that we're willing to surrender the ego and move into the true self, into the center, where it becomes not about us, but we turn our life and our will over to God. When someone is willing to surrender themselves and accept they're not all that and that it's about something different, they can actually have an incredible shift of consciousness, an incredible shift of how they see the world. It's not about, again, fortifying the self by trying harder. It's about accepting that this small self can do nothing and moving into a whole other paradigm. And apart from that sort of experience, I don't think someone like Tiger really changes, but the type of situation he's in, if he so chooses, is also one of those places where that transformation can actually occur. I don't know if Tiger's at the end of himself or not. Depending on how big your ego is, sometimes it takes a lot. And the stronger the ego, oftentimes the longer it takes into life. I mean, for some people, they don't get there until their 60s or their 70s, and they've got near-death experiences. Whether or not this is enough to get Tiger to kind of let go of himself and go into something else, I don't know. But yes, people can change. And just because Tiger doesn't, back to the Tiger Woods effect, don't think that means that maybe your mate hasn't. You cannot judge your mate, if you're a hurt spouse, by what's happening with Tiger. They are not one-on-one. Each person has their own specific road that they've got to follow.
Well, an interesting question that they have in this same paragraph is, can someone that wrapped up in the excitement and power that those actions create let go of them?
Yeah, but to sit there and say that those they might not be tempted by that again would be foolish. Temptation isn't the problem. I always say that, you know, temptation doesn't define us. If temptation defined us, then the person with the most temptation would be the vilest person. And I happen to believe Jesus was tempted more than anyone else in history, and we don't consider him to be a vile person. And so once you've tasted that sort of thing, is there an allure that would make you think, I mean, is there a part of our broken nature that would make us think that that would still be a solution? And the answer is absolutely. However, when we recognize, and again, it's not by not wanting to do it. It's almost like I have to begin to shift the focus and be about something else. It's not about changing the behavior. It's about changing my life and what I'm living for. And when I'm living for living out of a new consciousness, more what I would call a God consciousness, and I'm not even trying to look at other people and self-satisfy myself. I'm just concerned about how myself is impacting other people. When I keep myself broken and humble, then I can be safe. But yeah, people will still be tempted.
Well, I was thinking about when they talk about the excitement and the power, I think that there might have been some pretty strong feelings of entitlement because of his position, the popularity that he enjoyed and so forth.
Well, and I think, you know, a lot of times, again, as I've treated people with a great deal of money, that there is a sense or power, that there is a sense of entitlement, and that's really scary. I know Dallas Willard has a great quote. He says that radical evil is nothing more than self-centeredness, and I think there's a lot of truth to that. And you know, the only way we're ever going to be able to overcome that sort of self-centeredness is, again, is accepting what we really are and what we're not. And so, yeah, and that the more we've got, the more we think, I guess that's the initial temptation, right? And that the author of Genesis talked about, that somehow we think we can be like God, that maybe we are a small God and we are deserving and all of these things. It's just that any time we begin to take that path where we're self-centered, we always end up destroying other people around us, and we become very dangerous.
Here's a question that someone online just sent in. It says, I know without God I would not have gotten through this far, but now I feel numb. Is time just an issue? My main task is to be kind and open.
And so when someone has a mate that has cheated on them, time is a huge issue. People have to grieve the loss that's involved with all of this. There are several things that I think the unfaithful spouse can do to help. There are several things Tiger could do, actually, to help Elin if he chose, and it's not even about money. I think just being able to acknowledge and help her understand that he gets what he did to her, rather than trying to justify or defend what he did and why he did it. I don't know if he's blamed her or not, but he needs to be able to kind of take his own responsibility, and he needs to be able to be empathetic. He needs to be able to be broken and humble and let her know it's not about her. Tiger would have done this if he had been married to anybody else in the world. And I think, you know, the one thing I kind of take consolation from this, I mean, his wife is beautiful. And for all of you out there that think if you'd been better in bed or you'd been prettier or whatever, that somehow maybe you could have stopped your mate from doing what they've done, I'll tell you right now, it's never about you. I would have done what I did if I'd been married to anybody in the world. If I'd married somebody named Jane or Sarah or Samantha, I would have still done the same thing. The problem was me and how I looked at life and how I thought life was about me and about my gratification, my inability to love people and to care about people. Recovery is about learning to love. It's learning that it's about really caring for other people and recognizing that our actions do impact other people. Tiger will always be dangerous until he begins to be more concerned about others than himself.
I want to say something about this where this person says, is time just an issue? You know, I used to think that time has had so much to do with it, because I felt like the more distance there was between the time of disclosure and, you know, where I was in my life, the less pain, the less, you know, the less of a memory there would be, and therefore less of an issue and less of a problem. And for us, that happened to be the case. And it's been like 24 years. 25 years.
This year.
But I will say, we have seen couples come into our weekends, and there's been maybe 15 years ago that the affair took place, and they are just now dealing with it. So getting through it, having the time be the issue of the healing, is not necessarily the case. Time is an issue in healing only if some things for some progress has been made in resolving the situation. So I have to say, when this person's, I know without God I would not have gotten through this far, but now I feel numb. Is time just an issue? Time is an issue in helping you feel better about it only if you have been getting some resolution to some of the situation. If not, just forgetting about it and letting time make your memory less vivid is not going to be any help at all.
One of the things that we do at the Fair Recovery Center is we have a course, an online course called Harboring Hope. Some of you online may have participated in that. We found that also being with other people to process through all of this is absolutely critical. And if any of you are struggling to get through it, you know, do something like the Harboring Hope course. That's a little bit different than therapy, simply because it puts you in a group of other people where you can talk about it openly. You'll find other people who really understand. It's very difficult, I think, when you've been betrayed. You just feel so alone and so isolated. And there's something just incredibly healing to just have people validate you and say, man, you know, I felt the same way. And who can put into words what you felt, but you couldn't even get into words. And one of the things the course does is it takes you through a kind of a three-month period, different aspects of this whole piece of recovery, and gives you that support system to work through it. So if you are stuck in that pain and you're still numb, you may find that being able to process it, being able to talk about it, being able to laugh about it eventually, finding support is something that can also help you work through that pain. And, you know, again, having a mate who's willing to help you is really nice, but you don't have to have your mates. You can still get over it, but find other people who can walk with you through this process.
Here's a good one. Why do we get so bent out of shape? Oh, wait, I think that's not the one. Okay, here we go. Tiger Woods, many affairs, sexual addiction, sin, or both. What are some signals for one who has been involved in many affairs is truly serious about expressing his or her sexuality in an appropriate and God-honoring manner? What is the relationship between forgiveness and establishing boundaries and consequences for one not honoring those boundaries?
That's a great question. Again, the first thing I look for in that type of situation is the person being able to accept responsibility, not trying to justify their behavior, seeing what they've done, and admitting that maybe they don't know everything. I mean, let's face it. When I have somebody who's open channel and they're willing to admit that maybe they've got a problem, that's a really good starting place.
Another one down below here says, why do we get so bent out of shape when a celebrity, a pastor, the president, or any politician gets caught in an affair? Have we all assigned these people of high public profile qualities that are other than human? Why is it so upsetting to find out that they really aren't any different from the rest of humanity?
You know, we love, I think, and human beings are a little bit strange. The very fact that we like to have heroes, I think, probably reveals the fact that for the majority of our human existence, or maybe for all of our human existence, we all fail. And when we have someone that it appears is succeeding, we do get really excited about that, and we'll try to hold those people up as public figures. However, what's sad about that is when the person that's on the pedestal falls, then we all get really excited at their kind of demise, because now we see that they're really just like us. And I kind of agree, there's something really sad that we would even think that somebody could actually do it. I mean, one of the things I tell people in my office is, how many people do you think have actually broken out of kind of this human cycle of failure that we all go through? And they usually say, well, one. And I'll say, right. And so, you know, the probabilities of you being number two are probably slim. But if you want to go for it, I'm all over that, because it's going to be quite a feather in my professional cap to say I worked with the second person in history to get it right. I think that it's got to be about another system besides requirement-based or performance-based system. It's about a system where we learn to love and we learn to care about other people genuinely. And it's about a system where we learn maybe to grow closer to the source of love. And when I'm trying to move into the true self and operate, participate, what I call a participation with God rather than just trying to imitate and be good, at that point, change actually begins to happen. But people by nature, we tend to fail. What makes it dangerous is when we can't accept that and we keep pretending that we're not failing, and that's where the hole continues to get deeper and deeper.
This is interesting. The last comment this person makes is, we need to remember that they are all as human as those of us who are low profile.
Right. It's really not. I mean, some of the best people I know are the low profile,
mm-hmm.
and some of the most humble. And, you know, humility, again, remember I said that you measure a person far more by refusals than by accomplishments. And as long as we think it's about accomplishments rather than refusals, we're going to always end up being terribly disappointed by those that we think have accomplished a lot.
Could you answer this one?
Okay. What is the relationship between forgiveness and establishing boundaries and consequences for one not honoring those boundaries?
I read that, but I don't think you answered it.
Yeah. I think that what you're saying is that if someone, I could be wrong here, but does forgiving mean giving permission to someone to do it all over again? And the answer to that is absolutely not. Forgiveness, I think if you go through Harboring Hope or some of the things we do with the ARC, is actually a gift you give yourself. Forgiveness really has nothing to do with the other person. But we would actually say there are two types of forgiveness. There's a vertical forgiveness, that's you releasing them. That's a forgiveness, I'd say, that's between you and God. And then there's a horizontal forgiveness, and that one's much more about reconciliation. Just because I forgive someone really doesn't give them permission to go on and do it again. If someone takes your forgiveness as a sign that they can go on, that person isn't safe. You need to get out of Dodge with a person like that. But boundaries, I think you certainly can let them know what the boundaries are. But understand that boundaries are for your sake and not for their sake. If you try to be your mate's Holy Spirit, if you try to operate their program, ultimately nothing is going to happen good for you. It's actually just going to kind of backfire for you. You can't be your mate's motivation. Ultimately, for the unfaithful spouse like Tiger, if he begins to do things ultimately to try to save his marriage, then the probabilities of Tiger succeeding are absolutely zero. I mean, let's face it, even the best golfer in the world still hasn't, you know, doesn't hit every shot perfectly. And if his motivation is saving the marriage, he's going to have lots of motivation to do the right thing as long as the marriage is bringing him all the blessings that he wants. But when it gets to the place where the marriage isn't making him happy anymore, where's his motivation to continue doing the right thing? And so oftentimes, I think the unfaithful spouse thinks the goal is going to be to try to save the marriage, when in reality, the goal needs to be to save their life and to maybe have something positive come out of them. If their mate chooses to stay with them, you know, they're blessed. But they need to first learn how to be less self-centered if anything positive is actually going to happen. And in terms of people breaking boundaries, follow through. If they're not safe, if they can't follow through with their agreements, if they're not being consistent, if they're still putting themselves at risk, you need to get away from them. I mean, there's nothing about forgiveness that says you have to put yourself continually in harm's way. At the same time, one of the things that I teach is when someone fails. In recovery work, we always say it's progress, not perfection. And so to me, that means if someone fails and they're very broken and they're right back on the path and they see where they made a mistake and they're taking responsibility, and that person is probably still at a very good place. Where I look at someone having kind of a slip, that it's a problem, is when they begin to be ambivalent about it, or they don't care about it, they don't care about the impact, they're defensive about it, they're not necessarily addressing it, that person isn't nearly as safe and poses a potential problem. Do you have another question?
Well, I do. This person says, starts out by just saying, my husband had multiple online dates affairs right under my nose, then said he deserved it. But then says he deserves me too. She says, I know the pain this Ms. Woods is suffering, especially when the man is caught. I don't have the media slashing about, but I was full of shame, doubt, felt unlovable, and still do. I wanted to leave and divorce. I have two children, one autistic, and I am disabled. Please answer why infidelity is such a shameless activity for cheaters involved.
I don't think that infidelity for most people is a shameless activity, only because most people hide it. If it was a shameless activity, they would do it out in public and they wouldn't be hiding it. However, if you've got somebody who kind of has that, you need to get over it, all guys do this, where they don't really care about how they impact you with their actions, I mean, I come back in my worldview, that's not love. They're just interested, again, in their own life. And if you can't love and care about another person and how you're impacting them, it's not a safe relationship. And I do know that people are in very difficult situations. I mean, certainly at the Fair Recovery Center, we've seen many people that are in horrible situations where it would be very difficult to leave simply because of life circumstances. I have to believe that you got to do what's best in terms of taking a risk. I would rather see somebody go to a safe house, a shelter, and do what's necessary to protect themselves, and trust that somehow the community around them and family, that people will come in. You don't have to settle. There are ways to get out of it. Even though it seems impossible, it might be difficult. I hope you can find enough faith to trust that it may be hard this year, but in 2 years, maybe 3 years, there may be life. Because of someone like that, there's just going to be continued death, and that's sad. Any question?
Yes. This person says, Tiger not only let the world down, but will end up like O.J. Simpson, alone and in his own private cell, where he should be, to think and pray, not allowed to play his games that destroy innocent lives and people that love him. I'm glad no one ended up dead, and I hope Mrs. Wood stays where she is loved with her people and protect her children from this perverted man. My husband was verbally, sexually inappropriate with me and the children, and I didn't even realize it. The pervertedness comes out in many different ways, and it's very noticeable to the victim once there is discovery. There is no way Tiger Woods does not spill his sexual pervertedness into all of his life. Nobody has noticed because, as a society, we are too desensitized to it. It's definitely there. We need to get to the basics, which is only God can change someone. We can only change ourselves. God wants us to be good soldiers. I believe God would want us, victims of infidelity, protected and taken care of. But this isn't happening because women are the victims and we're the second-class citizens that should take it. It's a man's world. So there's not really a question so much as just making some comments about what the hurt party goes through. She said, I want to be a woman and love what and who I am. Just because I'm married to a jerk doesn't really reflect on me. I took the high road. She says, but I believe I should have been able to have a choice with some assistance to get myself functioning so I could make decisions, good decisions for my family.
I also want to read something here. I've got a friend that I hope she doesn't mind me doing this, but Peggy Vaughn. And she wrote this to me when she heard we were going to be talking about Tiger. And she just said, since you were interested in my perspective on various issues, I thought I'd offer a few comments about the impact of Tiger's story on those who are struggling to deal with affairs in their own lives. This is much the same situation as when Bill Clinton's affair was constantly in the news. And I agree with that. There was, every time a governor cheats, every time a president cheats, this has a profound impact on our culture. It just does. One underlying reason for the issue they face, whether it's throwing them back into the fear and doubt, the painful reminders, is that they may think that recovering from this experience means getting to the point where they don't talk about it anymore. And events such as Tiger lead them to talking about it and bringing back all of their fears and their reminders. Frankly, the goal of not talking about it is not the way to recover. And Peggy and I both agree on this 100%. I mean, this is why we have mentor couples. We find that couples who continue to deal with it, they actually weave it into the fabric of their life, that it becomes meaningful, it becomes a part of their story. It's a red flag. Let's see. And when couples tell me with pride that they never talk about it anymore, it's a red flag. It's unreasonable to think that any major crisis in your life would never be discussed. If you lost a limb or lost a child or experienced any major loss, it would be foolish to try to ignore and never discuss it as if it had never happened. A sign of true recovery is not when you don't need to talk about it. It's when you can talk about it, but without pain. And Steph and I certainly can talk about what went on with us without pain.
Mm-hmm.
That comes gradually, and there's no way to rush it. But continuously increasing the effort to talk with more rationality than emotionality eventually leads to this point. There will always be exposure of affairs among famous people, and there will always be books, movies, TV shows as reminders of affairs. So giving these events the power to throw you off track is an endless losing battle. In fact, you can use these inevitable reminders as an opportunity to talk about the issues of affairs in a less personal way. In that, you're not discussing your own personal experience, but it's someone else's. And in doing so, it's important to reflect on the experience of others in rational terms by assessing the various factors involved, rather than in emotional terms, by judging and ranting about others' behaviors. The bottom line is, what can you learn from these other situations that will give you a better grasp of the overall issues of affairs? The more they gain information, understanding, perspective about affairs in general, the better they'll be able to deal with their own situations. If any of this perspective would be helpful, feel free to use it. And I think, you know, Peggy, thank you. That's the whole thing. I mean, we want to be able to use these things in a positive manner. It's not about not talking and pretending that things never happened. It's always about growing beyond those things and coming to something else. So, Ms. Stephanie, you want to comment on any of that, or would you agree with Peggy?
No, I definitely agree. Because we still talk about it upon occasion, but there's no pain.
No, and I think, you know, we talk about all kinds of affairs in the media. I mean, obviously, we work with people with infidelity, again, which I think is another good reason for couples to continue to mentor other couples. I mean, you will learn to talk rationally about what happened, and that's when you know that many of the wounds have healed. Somebody made a question, Steph, I haven't gotten to it yet. It's about a heart. Can a heart mend, truly mend? And I really believe that hearts really can truly mend. But being able to learn to be rational and see it, and it takes a little bit of your mate, if you're going to continue as a couple, being safe to talk to about it.
You want me to read that question?
Yeah.
Mrs. Woods has the love, money, support more than any of us have, and did not have the wide open choice to get paid for being cheated on. I believe these men should go to jail for their crimes, especially when everyone involved is lied to and deceived. My husband's lovers believed I had died, so when I came back from the dead, they were surprised. They were apologetic, except for one, the one my husband saw first and most through the 2 years of his deserving affairs. She says, I pray for all married couples that they do what they have to do. Broken hearts do not mend. They just keep on beating, no matter what the situation.
And
I will never feel the same about my husband.
And, you know, I would agree that you may never feel the same about your husband, but how your husband ultimately responds determines whether or not you will see him with more respect or you never find respect for him again. And broken hearts do mend. We see it all the time. And it may take time. And there are situations when you're still in this healing process where the situations of politicians occur, these things get stirred up, and you have to deal with it again. But hopefully each time that becomes less and less. And again, if it's a chronic problem, and like we said in the beginning, you're dealing with PTSD, being able to get help is going to be important for that.
The next question is, does Tiger Woods should be criminally charged with emotional neglect of his family just because he paid the bills didn't give him the right to destroy the lives?
So is there a question there?
Yes. She says he's acting that he should have thought about what he was doing. My biggest question is, I believe my husband is a sex addict. He denies. We have sex 2 to 4 times per week and are 50. Why isn't that enough sex for my husband?
Okay. So for a sex addict, they're using sex not as a way of connecting and being one. Ultimately, they're using sex as a way of mood altering, such as with alcohol or drugs. And at that point, when you begin to use sex for kind of a sedative as a way of dealing with your own moods, again, you go straight to the place of using other people. And it's an insatiable desire. As the saying goes, at first, we eat to live, and then eventually we live to eat. One of the characteristics of an addiction is a growing tolerance, a need for more and more in order to ultimately satisfy. And so I think that, you know, you could have sex with him probably 5 times a week or 10 times a week, and it never would be enough because it's not about it's about a drug and an increasing need for a drug. It's not that there is ever enough of a drug to fix something.
This person says, can she ever feel whole again?
Do you think you feel whole again after what I did?
Absolutely.
How did you get to the place where you feel whole?
I saw a change in you. I saw you become the man, the godly man that I always had thought you were, but I saw a definite intentionality on your part to be different. You became part of an accountability group. I saw your relationship with the Lord change. All those things, I felt safe staying in the relationship. But I also realized one of the things that you talked about was that detachment thing. A healthy detachment. As one person talked about in here, I had you on a pedestal. You fell off that pedestal, and I felt like I didn't know who you were. But I felt like I was guilty for ever having put you on that pedestal because that was wrong. I had made you a god in my life, and that was wrong. So I had to change my perspective. I sort of had to change the way I looked at marriage. And when I did that, I recognized that my relationship with the Lord was much more important than my relationship with you, especially in the way that I had misconstrued the relationship with you.
Do you think you could have been whole if I hadn't changed, if I had continued on in my path?
If you had continued on in your path, we would have divorced.
Could you have become whole after that?
Absolutely. Because my wholeness was not dependent on you or your behavior or your love for me.
Right. And I think when people write questions like this frequently, we think that, you know, our ability to heal has something to do with the other person. And I really think it doesn't. I think, again, having my life rocked by something like this is a horrible thing. At the same time, it's the place where true change and transformation can actually occur. Certainly wouldn't wish it on anyone. At the same time, it's a rare and unique place. When people come up to Stephanie and I that don't really know our story and say, wow, you know, how could we have a relationship like you guys? We just kind of laugh at them and say, gosh, thank you, but you never would want to go through what you have to go through to get this type of relationship. And I would think, for both Steffi and I, we believe that the best marriages we know have actually gone through something like this. But what it has afforded them is the ability to be truly intimate, to talk about the really difficult things, to be fully known. And if we hadn't gone through this, I don't think I could have ever learned to be real, to be intimate, to be authentic with my wife, we would never have true intimacy. And so it wasn't until that failure occurred that that could happen. But I do think he would have healed regardless.
You were leading such a double life. I don't know how much longer you could have existed that way. And you learned about being transparent with me. So I really found out who you were. And you're right. I didn't know who you were. But, you know, you fell from the pedestal and I didn't even know who you were. And that's because you had never allowed me to even see into you because you had so much to hide.
If those of you that heard me read that Peggy Bond little her email that she sent me, Peggy wrote a really good book called The Monogamy Myth, or The Myth of Monogamy. Excuse me, Peggy, if you're listening. I'm so sorry. Can you Google that for me real quick? I think I just said her book wrong. But I love her book. I've read it. I just don't remember the title. And so I think any of you would really benefit from being able to read that.
Monogamy Myth.
The Monogamy Myth. There we go. Sorry about that, Peggy. Let's see here. There are many phases and degrees of self worthlessness that are associated. Have we done that one?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, find the next one. We're finally getting toward the end of things.
Well, one of the things that I thought was interesting was the person who said, let me find that. Did it make you feel more of a man when you cheated? And address that.
Yeah, no. It momentarily doing that makes you feel maybe powerful. It makes you feel really good about yourself. And then on the backside of it, it's empty. It's incredibly empty. And so it's only a temporary fix. And I think that when I'm in recovery meetings and I'm talking to men and women who are in recovery, and they all agree, the high is great. It's wonderful for that instant. But you end up living in a bubble where you have one high, and then you spend the next 23 hours and the next 17 hours, your next 48 hours, much time trying to focus on when you can get that next feeling like that. And it costs you your blooming life because you're living in a bubble. You're never in the moment. You're always planning, trying to get to the next hit, you know, and you're ignoring people and you're just completely enslaved by the thing. And so, yeah, you get to feel like a man and feel really special for 30 minutes. And then there's 48 hours of complete misery and abject, just almost emotional poverty. So it sucks. And it's crazy. So that's why Tiger can pick up somebody in the parking lot and then take somebody else, you know, hook up with somebody in the parking lot and then go take a maid home or whatever. I mean, there's just not enough. And because you'd have to be doing it 24/7 to ultimately keep that feeling like you're a real man, because it only lasts for a few moments.
That's all the questions. Please answer them all.
For those that are actually dealing with some of the trauma wounds, a couple of techniques that I suggest, because this is about emotional regulation, and hopefully in the near future we'll be putting out a course to help people with just emotional regulation. I think that first off, I always recommend trying to see a professional who deals with trauma. I think that can be really helpful. A lot of times when people are flooding, and it's good to remove yourself from the situation where the flooding is occurring and try to get yourself back in the moment. What a trauma does is it tends to pull you back into a past time. And if you can be focused in the moment, you'll find that you can really control the emotions. I have people a lot of times when they're flooding do things such as, I'll ask them if 273 is a prime number. Because if you start doing math problems in your head, believe it or not, you can't stay in that amygdala, in that reptilian part of the brain, and it'll force you to come back into the prefrontal cortex, and you'll begin to de-escalate. Another really great technique is to name objects in a room where you name like five objects and look in your direct vicinity, just around you, and see if there's any danger. And then if you can kind of do what I call an objective spectatoring, where you step back and from afar you watch yourself in this situation, or you try to imagine yourself how you're responding, but you're watching yourself in a television set that's in another television set. So you back up and you kind of observe how you're responding, and you'll begin to see if you can kind of spectator and be that observer and being mindfully aware of what's really going on around you in the moment, that'll help de-escalate those particular feelings. If you're flooding and it's at night and it's in the dark, get your feet on the floor, get a light on. You know, again, getting back into the moment. So much of emotional regulation when it comes to the flooding that occurs from this is about being able to stay very focused in the moment, moment by moment by moment. Another thing that's very helpful is don't give it airtime if you can avoid it. Instead, do what we call thought shifting and try to find other activities that would actually begin to occupy your mind. One of the things I have a lot of my people do is memorization, because interestingly enough, it's really difficult to flood and do memory work all at the same time. Is there anything, Seth, that you kind of use to help with that anxiety?
Well, I took index cards and wrote down scripture. I do have a sweet friend who gave me recently, though, what was it he gave me?
It was an iPod.
An iPod. And it had, she had put some wonderful Christian music on it. And I thought, now that is a great idea for someone who is really trying to control their thoughts.
Yeah, it's a way of giving yourself the ability to focus on something different. Mm-hmm. But remember, so much of this isn't about trying to avoid it. It's really about learning how to talk about it. And we're fixing to launch our next Harboring Hope. I think if anybody's interested in that and kind of processing through it and learning how to talk about it and learning how to look at it and gaining new perspective, the Harboring Hope course is a great way to go. And all you've got to do is go to the Affair Recovery website, look under resources, click on Harboring Hope. And that course will actually be starting in the month of January. So for those of you who have gotten really stirred up, or if you have friends who you know are struggling, certainly you can try to join one of those groups. If you've got several friends that y'all kind of deal together with this and you would like to all do the Harboring Hope group as a group, we can also accommodate that sort of thing. Just as Peggy said, so much of this is about learning how to talk about it. And I want to encourage you, don't be afraid. Do what you need to do to get healthy and whole. The Tiger news will eventually pass, but there will come another one. So you and your mate, learn to talk about it objectively. That being said, I want to thank all of you for joining us tonight. And I just hope you have a great New Year's Eve and a happy new year, and we look forward to being a part of your lives again in the near future.
Yes, happy new year.